These are the Target Files, taking a 21st century look back at the 20th century adventures of the Doctor in novelization and audiobook form, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, "There's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time." "So, what's so terrible about Perivale?" the Doctor asked. Ace sighed again. "Nothing ever happens here." Ace had wanted her homecoming to be spectacular. She had imagined the amazed greetings of her old friends, the gasps of surprise as she recounted her time-travelling adventures. But Perivale, on a summer Sunday, seems the least lively place in the universe. The members of Ace's old gang have gone away, disappeared. The Doctor has other things on his mind. What is killing the domestic pets of Perivale? Who are the horsemen whose hoofprints scar the recreation ground? Where have the missing persons been taken? Is the Doctor stepping into a well-prepared trap? And if so, can it be the work of the Doctor's old adversary, the Master?
Hello, this is the Target Files podcast. This is Alex in Exeter.
And this is Mike in Swansea. Hello.
And today we're going to discuss the audiobook of Survival, of course TV episodes of Survival, written by Rona Munro, an audiobook read by Lisa Bowman. So, Mike, what do you think of Survival in general?
A fascinating story all round, Al, released this week by BBC Audio, BBC Worldwide, read by Lisa Bowman, who played Kara in the TV episodes and has gone on to greater things in the world of Doctor Who as Bernice Summerfield in the Big Finish audios. Just a fascinating story, really had me grip throughout, lots of different layers, lots of great allegories towards the hidden beast within all mankind, really, all layered up in the suburban setting, which has become so synonymous now with the modern series since Russell T. Davis took over. And he himself has said this was a template for Rose back in 2005. So plenty to discuss, Al.
Has a lot of elements we've got now in sort of modern Doctor Who, obviously Russell took on board. And, you know, society eventually, you know, will either destroy itself or become better, I think, sort of elements to it. And I think Rona gets this over really well with having something what's meant to be sort of benign like cats and they're being completely different and the whole lots of different elements going on and lots of different sort of social events at the time and still going on, I think, are really well done in this book.
Yes, Al, I was wondering, rather than sort of dipping in later to the audiobook, shall we just do a mishmash of all the various versions, the audiobook, the novel and the TV version as we go along? Because we tend to dip in and out, don't we, rather than having to refer all the way back to an audiobook at the end of the episode.
Yeah, that's probably the best way, because it's like now we have three different things now, the book, the audiobook and the DVD of it. It's like lots of good versions of it now, and I think the audiobook, what's just come out this week, adds to those other two, I think.
Yes, very interesting soundscape to begin with. We get the suburban setting, we get the pots boiling within a neighbour's house when, as we see in the TV version, the gentleman is washing his car outside. Something comes from up above, there's a lovely crane shot in the TV version, and we just see him running away and we see his bucket of soapy water. It's a very good mishmash in the TV version and in the audiobook and the novel of the everyday suburban. You know, this is set on a boring Sunday afternoon, being totally disrupted by something horrific.
Oh, definitely. Sort of that whole first sort of scene where it's meant to be very suburban, sort of Sunday, you know, bossy cars having the race in, and it all sort of collides with what's going to happen, basically. And I think that's very much what he's trying to get over about how back then it's Sunday when it was the, you know, sort of quite a dull day. You know, these days we have shops all open all the time. There's lots more you can do on a Sunday. But back then it was like nothing was open. It was like the day you're meant to rest or do stuff, not do a lot, basically. And it, that sort of comes over a lot in this, you know, whole story. You know, where Ace goes, it's Sunday, nothing will be here, nobody will be here. Why did you bring me back on a Sunday, basically?
Yes, great line, isn't it? They mention about, well, me and you both sort of lived in smaller cities growing up, and there was definitely that vibe about the 80s. I know nowadays we have, as you said, shops open, we have a lot of sport going on, if you like sport on a Sunday. The internet is here, and we sort of forget, apart from some very great TV in the 80s in the UK on Sunday nights, there really wasn't much to do, was there, you know? And
no, Sundays were day you had to find, you know, not nowadays, there's plenty of options, but back then you had to find something to do. They sort of drag, and you were quite happy when you got to Monday. You know, it's sort of been lots of different things over from that, you know, over the years, that sort of great Tony Hancock sort of comedy where it's a Sunday, nothing happens. Sundays are completely different now to how they were, and I think you see that the old sort of Sunday in Survival, I think.
The Doctor and Ace arrive, materialised just after this point has occurred, with the gentleman apparently being scooped out of Earth, as we see later on. And Ace goes looking for her former group of mates, and it's very indicative of those teenage years when perhaps you've had a group of mates, as I did in school, and you all tend to go your separate ways. Obviously, I didn't go off to the stars with the Doctor, but I went travelling abroad and came back after a while and found that, you know, we'd all sort of settled down or done various things, and there's that definite vibe to Ace, isn't there?
Oh, definitely. I know exactly how you feel. I felt the same. At school and sort of not really through sixth form, so I went to college separately, but it's through school. You had that real tight gang of friends, and then you went off and did your own thing, and after university, and then, you know, because you always have Facebook, you try and find one, you see what your life is completely different. And I think Ace certainly feels that when, you know, she comes back to Perryville, and they're not there, and she sort of feels very detached, and I think she slightly blames the Doctor for that in these episodes.
Yes, definite tension with the Doctor, isn't it? And they go to a youth club where the excellent allegory is set up for, I think the character's name is Patterson. He's just like a Scottish former sort of military man teaching all these youngsters all these various martial arts and survival of the fittest skills, and that really sets up the central theme of the story, doesn't it? And how it affects us as humans.
I think that bit where they're at the youth sort of hospital there, and it's, you know, meant to be survival, and, you know, it's lots of this sort of Darwinian thing coming over, survival of the fittest. It's just very interesting allegory for the whole sort of thing that goes throughout the book, really, and the, you know, the episodes there. You know, you have to survive, you know, in some way to live, basically, in this area.
Yes, and throughout this, in the book and the audiobook and the TV show, there's the theme of a certain cat going around. Now, shall we talk about the special effects-wise, which perhaps weren't up to modern standards of looking at animals? Al, did you find that jarring in the TV version as I did?
I did find it a little bit, because they weren't the greatest, unfortunately. You know, the cats didn't look that great. You know, and I think it got better once you started having actual actors as, you know, the cheetah people were later in the episodes, and that looked better. I think, yeah, I will agree. The special effects would have been done better if they redid it now, I think.
Talking about the cheetah people, perhaps the costumes aren't the best, but the way the people embody them, the likes of Lisa Bowman, are obviously by this point in 89 already experienced movement performers, aren't they? Because they really sell the idea of the cat's movements and the fact they're all hunting in packs and looking for their prey. They sell it so well in their performance.
I know the costumes look a bit like weird fur, it doesn't look that great, but the way they actually move on the horses and sort of movement of the character has sort of great, you know, theme. And you have to, appreciate, you know, the fact that they were boiling under those costumes and getting sort of sand and rubbish into those disgusting yellow contacts they were wearing. So, as you know, you've heard the nightmare stories of survival and how, you know, people just went mad and that they're doing survival. So I think that though they're not the greatest costumes, they do look quite fantastic, so I think.
Yes, try not to spoil it for future convention appearances, folks, but Sylvester McCoy does tell one or two very good stories about the filming of this. I think it was in Sussex in midsummer, and he recalls, not to be too spoilery about Sylv's stories, he does recall one of the actresses in this hot fur running away for her life, and she may still be running to this day, 28 years later.
We have no idea where she went. In fact, it was so hot, she just went mental, apparently. And Sylv tells great stories about survival, because it was just very hot and very nasty wearing these yellow contacts they all had to wear.
Yes, I think, you know, despite this fact, I don't think they knew at the time this was going to be the last story as they were filming it. I've read this book, I've read the script doctor biography, autobiography by Andrew Cartmell. The great sense of camaraderie you get right through to the modern Doctor Who certainly existed back in those days under JNT and Andrew Cartmell.
Yeah, I think so, because it had that sort of, they had the sort of feel Russell T brought as well, you know, the whole, you know, you're there as a full team. I think Doctor Who has definitely had that all for the new era. But I think, like you, they obviously definitely didn't know this was going to be the final, you know, one they'd be doing, because I think that would have put a slight damper on it, and if it had known. But I think that it really works, that, you know, the whole camaraderie of everybody's there, and it's horrible, you're getting sand in your eyes, you're hot, you know, it never comes over. You know, I think it really does work, those bits on the planet.
Yes, and a lot of this team within this story are teleported to some planet, aren't they? Which we later find out is the whole idea of a living, breathing planet, which I did a bit of research, has gone right back in sci-fi to stories such as in 1931, a short story called The Menace from Andromeda brought up this idea. We had a planet called Taraji back in The Doctor's Wife with a villain called House, voiced by Michael Sheen in The Doctor's Wife episode. That was 2011. Al, it's always been a pretty popular theme in sci-fi, isn't it? It's usually how the planets represent issues in the person's mind.
Oh, yeah, definitely been in sci-fi over the years that the planets can be, you know, can have their own personality in life. And there's a very interesting missing, one of the stories they didn't do called Earth Aid or Big Finistic, about a whole planet that is completely symbiont and understands everything what's going on, basically.
Yeah, so I'm thinking of something that came through the BBC comedy-wise a few years later, which is Red Dwarf, an episode called, I think, Rimmerworld, was it?
Oh, yeah, well, anyway, it's all controlled by different rimmers. That's a very funny episode of Red Dwarf.
The scenes on the desert planet were far more enhanced than you could generally get in a 3-episode TV budget at the time. How did you feel about those?
It really come over a lot better in the audiobook and the book than they do on TV. Though it looks quite good, and I think because of the music and the score, what they had in the episodes, these are very good music score. It gives it a bit more, but I think the whole description of the dust and the dirt and the heat comes over much better in the book, I think.
Yes, Dominic Glerner, fabulous score on this one, folks. I think it's still available. You can find it out there on various...
It's actually being re-released in 2 weeks' time.
Oh, brilliant. To tie in with this audiobook, Al, or just a fate
so.
Of timing?
I think so. They're re-releasing it on the 21st, I think it is.
So do you know the record company? If you want to get... Is it going to be vinyl
it's
as well
on,
as...
It's on Amazon. It is on Amazon. If not, it's Silver Screen.
Silver Screen. And will that be vinyl?
Yes, there is vinyl and there is CD and download all forms, I think.
Oh, that sounds fantastic, folks. And I also want to talk about, you know, the technical presentation on the TV version itself. They really up the stakes with these quarries, I think, in the later 1980s era, don't they? We get the wonderful, shot of a beach, isn't it, rather than a quarry, in the Colin Baker Trial of a Time Lord season with all the pink of the skies in the background. And it's definitely taken into this as well in the Cheetah Planet, isn't it? You get these wonderful vivid colours, but you also get the haze of being in such a dusty environment on screen.
Yeah, those books do look rather nice. I have to admit, you get really bright oranges and nice, sort of really sandy and sort of hardcore lighting, and that bits, you know, will go along really nicely. And the sort of whole running of the horses looks beautiful in that sort of sand sort of effect they do.
Yes, character-wise, as we said, the Doctor and Ace have a certain amount of tension, and you alluded to the opinion that it's because Ace has been away for so long, and she partially blames the Doctor for that. And I think, does this story come after the revelations of Curse of Fenric and Ghostlight?
It is after those two. So you've had all that in-depth stuff about Ace and her backstory, and I think the sort of relationship with the Doctor is sort of slowly fraying, and I think if they hadn't been taken off, I think he would have got Love and War as the next one, basically, where Ace does leave the Doctor and you meet Benny. So I think there's definitely tension between the Doctor and Ace by this story, I think.
Yes, and then we get the more sort of tragic characters such as Midge and Kara within this. How do you feel they were represented all throughout, really, by the performances on TVL, by Lisa Bowman's performance? How do you feel they came across?
I think they come across really well in the book and on the TV. I think Lisa does a fantastic performance as sort of head of the cheetah people and somebody trying to persuade Ace to become more of a cheetah than her actual nature. And bits with her and Ace are really good. I really like Mitch, actually. I think he's a very sort of complicated character, sort of very trying to be, you know, streetwise, ahead of his time, and then ends up being turned into a pawn by the Master, really.
Yes, and we'll talk about the classic old villain in a minute.
This is Alex Gibbon's Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is Alex, and this is Hugh's News on the 10th of September. Well, first thing we've got to mention is that the Doctor Who Experience in Cardiff Bay finally closed yesterday, which is a sad event in my opinion. Lots of different things went on yesterday to celebrate its closing, and in particular, Chris Chibnall was there signing and doing photos outside. There is no news on its future, if it's going to be reopened either in London or Manchester, but there is speculation it might be Manchester, as jobs were advertised in Love Manchester, but not on the actual BBC job pages, so we will see what happens. Also have to mention, sadly, that BBC Three have finally decided not to do a second season of Class. Unfortunately, it has been finally cancelled. Though I think this is a bad decision, as on a second watch, it was much better. And we'll never find out now what the Weeping Angels were going to do with the school and the whole of the UK. From BigFinish.com last week, we have a new dramatisation of H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. Getting back to the original story, it stars Ben Miles. It is the latest release in the Big Finish classic range, which includes quite a lot of H.G. Wells these days, and most recently Shakespeare's Hamlet, and coming soon, King Lear, with David Warner as King Lear.
So, back to survival after the news. Al, really want to talk a little bit more than we have about the other characters, about the Master's last appearance, Anthony Ainley's last appearance as the character in the show itself, although he did appear in inserts for the Destiny of the Doctor's computer game about a decade after this. What did you make of the way Anthony Ainley performed the Master in his final appearance, the way Lisa Bowman performed the character in the audiobook, and how Ronan Munro wrote the character?
End of the first episode, you see him and he's very sort of malevolent, and Ronan Munro gets that over very well. So does Lisa in her reading of the audiobook. It's, you know, very sort of slinky and, you know, sort of very nasty Master. It's very sort of, you know, back to the John Pertwee, I think she was trying to get with Lisa was, and it's a very interesting portrayal of the Master, I think, in this survival, because he's definitely more nastier. He's definitely more like the Master we've got at the moment, and it definitely made me think of him, you know, listening to this again, as the more one we had in the Paul McGann movie. He's more determined to get his own way. He sort of doesn't care who he kills in the process. And I love the way he sort of manipulates people, you know, like the way he manipulates Mitz for the whole of this storyline. I think he comes over really well in Ronan's writing, I think.
Is it unfair that fans sometimes label him as a bit more pantomime, in particularly, I think, the Davison episodes? He's almost like a bit of a fanboy himself then in the Mark of the Rani, the Collins story. But at this point, I think he's really menacing in Survival. He himself only shows a lot of layers, and that's definitely expanded upon in the novelisation and the audiobook performance.
I never think like he is pantomime. I thought in the Mark of Rani he was actually very good against the Rani. I think there's a good between them. I think that's really good. And I think in Survival it's very pared down. There's not a great deal of pantomime camp that's sort of we've known with the Master and that. It's very, I'm on my last legs. I've had to become part of the planet, become a cheetah nearly to survive. And it's about surviving. Because I think he knows that he's very near the end of his regenerations, I think, and he's very close to death. And he knows that he has to sort of get rid of all those sort of pantomime comedy bits, what we've seen in the past. So I think it's a much better performance. So I like him in Mark of the Rani, though, so I'm a bit biased there.
Yeah, there's quite a large part of Chapter 5, I think, it is, Al, and it really explains his motivations, really, more than I think we've seen in any other Target book covering the Master so far. It really relays back to the history, and it just makes you think of the old-school villains, whereas nowadays in TV and film and books, we tend to get backstories for villains, why, what happened to them as children, why they ended up like this. But with the Master, it's just sort of a game, as in the allegory of a game in this story, in terms of Survival of the Fittest. That appears to be the Master's sole motivation, whereas it's evolved again in the new series to almost become stalkery of the Doctor with the John Sim and Michelle Gomez incarnations. This is pure sport for the Ainley incarnation.
Yeah, I would agree. I think he just sees it as a game between him and the Doctor. There's lots of bits when Ace asks why he's doing it, so it's malice, it's revenge, He's a very more stripped-down Master, I think, in this episode. And I think that works very well. And I think John Sims' Master has picked a bit of that up, but there's still a lot more panto camp, I think, between the new Masters, which I love a lot. But I think this is one of the best portrayals of the Master in this story and the episode, I think. And I think, we get villains in a lot of things, like in the whole sort of Marvel world and superhero world, but you always have to have the backstory. You always have to know what's their sort of motivation. And I think, do you really, in the general, care about that? As long as they can do a part well, I think.
Yes, I don't know if it's just a fact of, 80s children growing up, we all had polarised opinions of what was good and what was bad. You just had a goodie and a baddie. But nowadays, we always have to have the background explanation. I think we even got it, didn't we?
I can see where you're coming from, because whenever you get a baddie or a villain in now, they always have to have, they have flaws. They just can't be, evil or good. They always have flaws, and that displays the evil. I'm like you, why can't you just have somebody who is just completely evil? And I think the Master in Survival falls into that category. There's no sort of redemption at all.
Yes, shades of grey nowadays, I think. And within that Chapter 5, towards the end of this pretty large section, which is thoroughly fascinating about their history, the Doctor just sort of says, what if I let him win a game of chess so many years ago? Would all these things have happened? And it gets you wondering about certain decisions that the Doctor makes and how they have echoes in eternity, as his own explanation of something else might also represent.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, this whole scene from the late bit of Sylvester's time and a bit into the Paul Gambit here, we seem to be seeing, the whole chess thing come out a lot. We have it in Curse of Fenric, we have it in sort of metaphorically in Survival and a lot in the, later Big Finish things.
Yes, Alan, as we move towards the end and we have that wonderful bloodlust battle between the Master and the Doctor, both their eyes turning viciously red in the TV versions, so well layered, so well written by Rona in the novelisation, and Lisa doing a great job, I think, with these male voices. She really captures the grit, as we said, the extra layers to the Ainley Master, I think, in this story.
Oh, well, most definitely, most definitely. I think that last bit is... It's really good on TV, but it seems a bit quick on TV. I think that whole bit with the motorbikes and that is a bit quick, where in the book it really ramped up the tension. The way Lisa really, it was really, really good. I mean, you got into the tension of that sort of, are they going to collide or not, and then going to the other world. And she really does get Sylvester's voice quite close. And, like, you know, she was physically shouting that, you know, the great line, if we die like, you know, if we die like animals, you know, we'll die together, that sort of bit. Came
out
really well, I think.
Yes, it's just got me thinking, perhaps Lisa's slightly one of the slightly younger readers of The Range than we've had recently. Do you feel she speaks, I'm not going to say so quickly that you don't understand it, but she speaks with a certain greater pace, I think, than some of the novels we've covered recently?
Yeah, I would agree. Lisa does speak quite fast, but ways when she actually speaks like that. So you sort of do get used to it if you've listened to a lot, like I have on the Benny audiobooks for Big Finish, and the stuff where she's in Jacob and Lightfoot. It's the way she speaks, and it is a, I suppose it's more of a modern way of speaking than some of the other readers we've heard, like, you know, it's not really what how Lou would speak, or maybe Bonnie, or, you know, on the female front, or even you know, David Troughton. You know, it's the way, I think it's the way people speak sometimes.
I think it's slightly sort of breathy, puts people in mind of the younger Peter Davison Doctor on TV. Slight bit of frantic nature to it, but that sort of continues throughout, and she doesn't necessarily ramp that up within these sort of deep action scenes from, say, the very earliest scenes in the suburban setting. But what really impressed me about her performance is that she's able to slip in and out of accents so easily. You know, you have two Scottish accents in this audiobook. We have Patterson, the sort of mad drill instructor, he's very Scottish, and of course Sylvester's Doctor Scottish, and she seems to turn between that and just reading the general narrative really so quickly. I don't know if that's just an editing thing, but I would probably think that's just a strength of her as an actress.
I think knowing her, it's probably just no editing. I reckon that's what she does when she reads it. And like you, I think it's just fantastic, because there's like loads of different voice changes. There's all the different Scottish, there's Ace, there's the two Hale and Pace characters, because he gets so well, quite fun. And there's all different voices, which I think he just does so well.
Yes, at the very end, following the solution, Al, we get the lovely scene on telly where Ace is looking into the flames of a fire. I thought pretty well represented in the audiobook and the novel. But we don't get the little add-on that we had when Andrew Cartmell, I think, knew at the time that this was going to be the last show, certainly for a while at the time. Sadly, it was the last of the classic ongoing series. What do you feel about that as an omission from the book? Because this book was published, I think, in... Let me double-check, folks. Got the book here. 1990. So, I suppose Doctor Who was up in the air then. They might have thought it may have been coming back sooner than it did in any sort of format. How do you feel about the decision to omit that, Al?
I think they sort of kept it personally on the audiobook because, you know, they could have easily added it now because it's been there for nearly, you know, 20 years now. I think it really added something in the end of the episode, you know, between Ace and the Doctor. You have that hope put back into it. You've had, like, three stories where, you know, Ace has sort of done, yeah, character development, but he sort of ends up, you know, pretty battered and bruised by the end of Survival, I think. And it just adds that extra bit of hope. Yeah, I think it was definitely put in because and Carla knew it was a goner, basically, by that, I think.
It's looking at the wonder of the world and that Doctor's almost childlike fascination at times, because the last line on TV is, you know, somewhere the tea's getting cold. And I remember Peter Capaldi speaking at a series launch a few years ago saying that the Doctor can find equal wonder in looking at a vast vista of planets in the sky, but then he can also find wonder in an empty plastic bag blown across a supermarket car park. Those lines sort of capture something about Doctor Who, don't they?
The wonderment and the childishness of the Doctor, and you know, so that I think that's what hooked me again was that great scene in the, you know, the first episode of the new season, Rose, when C.R. Stewart and Chris Evans is that great speech, and it's all about the small things, and that's what I think the Doctor can be. He can be really childish and then really serious on a, you know, flip of a coin, really.
Yes, thinking of Patrick Troughton in The Power of the Daleks as well, given this very serious speech, then somebody walks past with a plate of food and, oh, fruit!
Yeah, it's just that, isn't it? It's that, the fact that you can be deadly serious in saving the world, and then a second it's a bit of fun, and that's how life should be. And it shouldn't be all serious all the time.
Should we talk, Al, a little bit about the cover?
Yeah, definitely.
Yes, an Alistair Pearson one, just the one printed edition in 1990 here in the UK. We have the Doctor Who Sylvester McCoy logo. We have the pink background, as we said, of those beautiful pink skies in the TV episode.
Very nice.
Sylvester sort of blended in the pink of his skin, and his camel-coloured, usually, hat is sort of blended in with the pink as well. Right through to the top of his suit, we have Ace with those beautiful cat eyes and Kara next to her, and then a black cat one side of the pink planet above the ridges and hills on the desert planet, and Ronan Munro in black. It's a very impressive Alistair effort. We also, I've just noticed, have the question mark, which was synonymous with those 80s era. A bit of controversy with some fans, but a very good design by Alistair. Apparently, reading up on the TARDIS wiki page, originally Alistair Pearson had designed this to feature the Master in the Kitling design, but it was simplified to the Black Cat in the final cover hour. So, yes, I'm very impressed with that. I imagine it looking very good close-up. I can't remember if we saw it in our brief stop at the Experience last week before it shut, when we saw those covers on the wall, but
I think it was, though, actually, thinking about it. And that's a really nice cover that sort of tells you everything that, you know, you want to know. I expect if you want a larger edition, it's in the new calendar, what's coming out of his artwork.
Absolutely, and we can only hope those Target covers are moved elsewhere here, Al. I've just noticed as well, in the back of the novelisation, which I picked up from a great bookshop in Cardiff in one of the arcades, if you search for it, folks, online, is Troutmark Books, which usually has a decent range of second-hand Targets being put in there. Troutmark, not spelt like the great Patrick Troughton, just the fish spelling. The fish spelling, T-R-O-U-T, no G-H-T, M-A-R-K, and it's in, I think, maybe the Castle Arcade opposite the Castle in Cardiff, so if you're looking for old Target books, folks, have a look in there if you're in the Cardiff area. But we did have a postscript from Peter Darvill Evans, who was editor of the W.H. Allen Doctor Who books at the time, saying it was the last Doctor Who story to date. As he wrote this in June 1990, the BBC have not yet announced the production plans for further seasons of Doctor Who. And he mentions, we shall start to publish new completely original Doctor Who novels in 1991. The Doctor's adventures will continue onwards from here, from the end of Survival. So that was a little tease for fans, but it must have been pretty shocking at the time not to have any more new shows to come, Al.
Yeah, I was thinking that. That must have been the year what Virgin Publishing started the new adventures. And it must have been a real blow, because you didn't have anything. You didn't have... I just want to remember, I don't think the BBC announced anything. It's just you had, you know, the last episode of Survival, and that was it, and you were sort of, what's going to happen? You didn't know anything. And then luckily DWM, I think, in their news bit started saying, oh, Virgin Publishing are going to release new books called the New Adventures range, and it's like, wow, what are they going to be like? And they were rather good, and they were, you know, half the people who wrote them are now running the show.
I mean, I have mentioned before that I may have been slightly put off during the Colin Baker era, if there was sort of more action-based stuff over on ITV, like we had the A-Team imported at that time. But I did watch the end. I do recall watching the Trial of the Time Lord and the McCoy series as it moved to Monday evenings then, out of loyalty more or less at the time. But I do remember even thinking at the age of 12 that things had definitely picked up in season 26. It was a lot darker. It was what I was looking for on TV as I moved towards the teenage years. But then had a pretty big gap, didn't we, Al? You know, between the age of 12 and 18, 19 for me, before McGann appeared again, and then another 9-year gap. So, were you a avid collector of things in the wilderness years? I really wasn't, to be honest. I only sort of watched the TV movie and really got back in when RTD brought it back so spectacularly well in 2005.
I was really into the... I used to read DWM, you know, when it came out every month, and I was really into the New Adventures books. I read quite a few of the New Adventures books because they were really well written, and they had... I thought they were just how you wanted the Doctor to be. It was like they were always a lot more darker. They had, you know, quite a lot of violent sex and strong language in them, and they were not generated towards the same children audience. And That's a really clever thing that he's gone, like, you know, you used to get these really cool one-year things called Decalogues, which would be all the, you know, eight Doctors having a connection and having great stories. And as we've seen, the people who wrote this stuff, basically, eventually, I went on to run Big Finish, or they went on to run the new seasons.
Absolutely fantastic what fandom could do in those days. You know, there was some debate about how much it did keep the flame alive. It certainly kept Doctor Who as a brand alive, didn't it? You know, and you still had the American conventions going on in those, what are called the wilderness years. But I think Paul Cornell has gone on record as saying he calls them the theme park years, because there was so much going on fan-wise and in officially sanctioned novelizations, as we said, Al, and then the rise of Big Finish.
Yeah, I think looking back at it all now, because, you know, as we know, it's now 30 years this week, that's, you know, since Sylvester started, and just that whole period, I think, just, you know, was really good from, you know, from season 24, and then it sort of stopped, and then slowly built back through the wilderness years with things like New Adventures and Big Finish, and luckily, you know, we had enough there to keep the gap going. I personally think it was always a gap going. Like, I came a little bit late to Big Finish. I didn't come to until early 2000s, and sort of, I think I sort of stepped away from Doctor Who for a bit and then got back into it. I was at university, so it's like, I think it was always there in my life from, you know, over the wilderness years, and I think it's just been great that it's, you know, it's come back in such a brilliant way.
Yeah, something I did discover this week, Al. An animated fan project, which has all six parts now, of the 30th anniversary story, Lost in the Dark Dimension. And it is so well done. It is one of the best fan productions I think I've ever seen. I think they've based it on the original script for what unfortunately evolved into the Dreadful Dimensions in Time, which was going to be a proper, I think at the time they were planning to release it as a BBC sell-through video and possibly not show it on TV till afterwards. We were going to get Lost in the Dark Dimension as a multi-Doctor 30th anniversary story, with Sylvester fairly prominent, but Tom Baker taking more of a prominent role, as the story involved him being sort of scooped out of time by another evil being as he just before he fell off the Pharos Project Tower in Legopolis, which does cause his regeneration in the timeline that we know.
That's an interesting one. I've seen that. I think I followed that on Facebook, and it's all. Where can you watch all four episodes? Is that on YouTube?
I think they've done six altogether, because I'd only seen four or five before, Al, and the sixth was put on YouTube earlier this summer, and it has the proper ending on there, and it ties up very nicely and animated so well and edited. Everything is great about it.
Definitely, I think I need to have a look at that. I do know about that. I follow them on Facebook. It's like, as we know, there seems to be an awful lot of, you know, fandom stuff that sort of sprung up before the whole Russell T Davies thing, and it always has really good stories or good plot. I think we've seen quite a few, you know, different events like Regen. There's always a thing on the Saturday night with different sort of fan films and that. They've always been really good, the ones I've seen there. So I think it just carried on nicely after Survival. I know there was a lot of, will it come back? When it come back? And then are the Americans going to run it all like they tried to with the whole Paul McGann thing, which we love. I know there's a lot of people out there who hate it because it was going to be Americanized, but I think it ended up in the right place eventually, and it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the Chris Chibnall bit. Are we going to move all the way from Cardiff? Is that whole infrastructure going to go to, you know, England and Manchester? It'll just be very interesting to see what happens in the next couple of years.
There is a Doctor Who Confidential episode, I think broadcast after Blink in 2007, where David Tennant speaks to various people involved in the production of the show and the Wilderness Years, including Moffat and RTD. RTD actually states that Doctor Who is now so iconic within this country and the world, it's like a Sherlock, it's like a James Bond, it will always come back now. So it's unlikely to think we'd have certainly a 16-year wait with only one TV movie again.
Yeah, I don't think there will be ever a gap now, because it's such a big, you know, brand for the BBC. It's, you know, like, you know, this is quite ironic. I mean, they hated it and got rid of it, and then now brought it back, and it's like, you know, they're one of their flagship programs now, which is, in my thing, I find quite ironic. But yeah, I think there's probably no chance of losing it now, unless something majorly goes wrong with the whole reboot of Chris Chibnall and Jodie Whittaker, which I really don't think will be a problem. You know. You know, I think the only thing that will really, really might lose audience is if they go with a female companion as well as a female doctor. Well, I personally think that would be a good mix, but I think that might really alienate the old guard of big Doctor Who fans.
I think she's going to be fabulously successful. She's going to beat Tom's record. There, I said it.
You've said it now. I think she will be great. Whatever she does, she's great. Well, I think, you know, what will really noodle classic Doctor Who fans is if they give her a female companion as well, I think.
Well, there's a whole Bradley Walsh rumour, and it's possible he may be the father of a either female or male younger companion.
Yeah, that might work. That might probably happen. It's a very interesting one if that rumour is true about Bradley Walsh. That, you know, because I've been watching more stuff in, and I think he is actually quite a passable actor. And after watching the clown Sarah Jane episode, that sort of semi-convinced me that he might be quite good.
Yes, and done Law and Order here in the UK, but still just a rumour, folks. There have been rumours of an announcement of some sorts, Doctor Who, on the 15th of September, as we record this on the 10th, so that may be Doctor Who experience related, or it may be companion and new series related, which is rumoured to start rolling behind the cameras, or in front of the cameras, in November this year.
Also, big finish that they were announcing on the 15th.
Could be something very interesting then. That's Sylv. Sorry, that's Sylv getting in my ear, or rather my bad impression, telling us we need to wrap up and say what we thought of Survival Al. Should we give a general overall score for the TV version?
Definitely. You got there just before. I was just about to get us back online discussing the end score.
So the TV version, the novelisation, and the newly released audiobook performed by Lisa Bauman.
Right. I really always enjoyed Survival, the TV version. I think it's really well shot. I think the soundtrack is fantastic in it. Lots of sort of Roy Cooter sort of guitars, and it feels very sort of desolate and airy, and the whole cat planet, the cheetah planet, is done fantastically. Really enjoyed the book because I think it's more detailed, it's more in depth, it gives you a lot more backstory to what the cheetah planet, you know, how Ace feels about becoming a cat, and the whole Master Doctor story, and why, you know, the Master hates the Doctor, and the whole sort of manipulation of the other characters in the sort of play in Perryville, and the whole Mitz Master thing's really good. Lisa Bauman does a fantastic reading of the audiobook. She gets every character right. Sylvester McCoy performance is not 100%, it's like 98% perfect. I really enjoy it, and I think it had a really good soundscape. There's like lots of background noises for Perryville and the sort of when he hit the cheetah planet. So I think overall I'm going to give the TV episodes an 8.5, the book about a 9, and maybe the audiobook about a 9.5.
For me, I think the book and audiobook are so good. Might be a strange decision here, but it actually knocks the TV version down half a point for me. So I'm going to give that 7.5 because I don't think they captured it as well as they could. You know, there could have been more expansion between the Doctor and Master story on the TV version, which Rona has written so well in the novel. So I think from an 8, the TV version is going to get a 7.5. As you said, though, the music, some of the shots are wonderful. Novelisation, 8.5 or 9, I think. And Lisa's performance is great, adds even more to it. So I'm going to give that a 9.5. So, thoroughly enjoyable one, Al. Really good way for Doctor Who to go out, sadly, as it did at the time. Really want to hear Lisa perform some more audiobooks now.
Definitely, because I think there's still some left of the 7th Doctor ones that haven't been done yet, have there? So I think she's more likely to do those than others, I think.
Yes, so looking at next time, Al, just realised I think it was a year ago we were at the final Regenerations Con. If you're listening, Carrie, please do another one. I know it's a very stressful business for you, but we'd all love you to bring it back, no matter what sort of gap you have for it, if it's a couple of years' time. But we recorded...
We don't mind, because it is always the most well-organised, easiest one to get around in my boat, and it's just a really fun weekend.
Yes, at that event last year, we recorded our thoughts on The Mysterious Planet, the first of the Trial of the Time Lord. So shall we return to that one next, Al, with Mind Warp by Philip Martin?
Definitely. I think, you know, it's about where I will give them the next bit.
Great stuff. Thanks for that, Al.
Next time, Doctor Who Target Files will be discussing Doctor Who Mind Warp, written by Philip Martin, along with the audiobook read by Colin Baker.
Contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle, or search Facebook for the Doctor Who Target Files podcast page and leave a message. Thanks for listening. Doctor Who Target Files Survival Review featured Alexander Gibbons and Michael Winks. Survival theme composed originally by Dominic Glynn. 12th Doctor theme composed originally by Murray Gold. Version for the podcast by YouTube user Vale Mystery. Please do check out their YouTube channel VAYLE Mystery. Newsround opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files Survival Review was recorded in Swansea, Wales, UK, and Exeter, Devon, England, during September 2017.